It's Lions, Towers, and Shields from the Incomparable Network. I'm your host, Shelley Brisbane. Welcome back to a discussion of classic film. This is episode 87, Night of the Hunter. Tonight we discuss Night of the Hunter, a 1955 film directed by Charles Laughton, starring Robert Mitchum, Lillian Gish, Shelley Winters, Billy Chapin, James Gleason, and some other character actors you might or might not recognize. But that's not really all that important, is it? What's important is to introduce my panel of guests to talk about this film with me. First of all, Randy Dittinga. Hi.
You know, if I seem a little distracted, Shelley, it's just because I'm lying here thinking about my canning.
That was mine. Thank you for getting that in. And next up, it's Dr. Drang. Welcome.
Beware of false prophets, children.
Last but certainly... children. Last but certainly not least, it's David J. Lohr. Hiya.
Coming to you live from one of them Sodoms on the Ohio River.
Appalachian Gothic.
That's right.
Yes, friends, we have much gothicness, much religiosity in the guise of Gothic, also some German expressionism thrown in, which is kind of funny considering that the director is an English dude. But be that as it may, let us begin by establishing our bona fides on this picture, Night of the Hunter. I want to find out whether each of you has seen it and what's your experience with it. Randy, how about you? Is this new to you or no?
I've seen it before, and it's a fantastic, really strange, creepy movie. And one thing that really I was thinking about a movie that we talked about recently, Sunset Boulevard, and how these are both from the same early 50s, about insanity and depravity, and how both directors were sitting around and thought, you know, who should be in this movie? Somebody who was a star 35 years ago. What, you know, what is Mabel Normand up to? Because we could just find somebody from back then to be in this movie. And I was thinking it would be the equivalent now of looking back 35 years for a current star for a movie and thinking, hey, how about Steve Guttenberg? What? That would be a great idea. This is just, yeah, there's just so many things that are really stunning about it. And I was just reading, we could talk about this later, how this the original novel was inspired by a real life Bluebeard, a real life guy from Moundsville, West Virginia, which is a real place, and his killing spree. And his habit of befriending ladies who came to unfortunate ends. So there's a real life, but the real life story is fairly different, but you can see a lot of similarities too.
Sort of kind of ripped from the headlines. And I'm just imagining Gloria Swanson playing the Lillian Gish role. Children, come up here now. Anyway, I think not. Dr. Drake, how about you? Have you seen this film before?
I have seen it a couple of times. And of course, I think even before I saw it, I knew about, I mean, you know about the love and hate on the knuckles. And there are just parts of this movie that you know, I think very much like Norman Desmond, you know the characters, you know Robert Mitchum's character, you know children, right? I don't know anybody who hasn't heard that, you know, at whether they've seen the movie or not. But I do know that I have seen it before, and I remember the first time I saw it, I was pretty surprised that Lillian Gish was in it. That was something I didn't know going into it, and don't really know a lot about Lillian Gish except the name, and I was kind of surprised. I feel kind of sorry for her, which we'll get into later on, for the kind of load she has to take in this movie.
Yeah, she actually kept acting after the silent era a lot more than others of her era did. But we can talk about that a bit later. David, how about you? What's your background with this movie?
Well, of course, I've seen it just out of fascination with film noir. And it is a very different film noir from most of the ones I had watched when I had my first flush of, you know, ooh, you know, guys in snap brim hats and, you know. It is a fascinating, unsettling movie. It is very contemporary in a lot of ways. Not necessarily in the Brechtian theatricality of it, or the German expressionism, or even the silent movie techniques and stagings and lightings, all of which are really cool examples of all of those things. But just in terms of portraying an abusive, I mean, literally an abusive stepdad, who is, the term nowadays that they use is coercive control, and the way he tries to divide and conquer, the way he forces people to bend to his will, and then the PTSD that the boy in the story has by the end of the movie. And it is just fascinating to see that so clearly in a 1955 film, and then to see, to just being amazed that it got made at all in 1955 with someone who, I mean, okay, you can say he's posing as a preacher, but he's a preacher, and he's not a good person at all, right? And I know that was something that they had to fight. They had to struggle to get it made as faithfully to the book as it is. So it is kind of an astonishing film that way.
Yeah, I think it was actually banned in Memphis, and mm-hmm. I think someplace else because of the, I assume because of the content of regarding the preacher, and whoever heard of a bad man of cloth before? That's something.
Hmm. Yeah, the issue with making it was that it portrayed a preacher as evil, and you're right. For all intents and purposes, he's a preacher because many of the people in the film believe he is. And he and Shelley Winters, when they get together, they do revivals for a while. Her neighbors, her busybody boss, and her husband believe he's a preacher, and so therefore he functions as a preacher, at least to that group of. But everybody, even at that point, the viewer of the movie already knows he is not, and that he's a bad person, which is interesting. But it's still controversial.
Right, right. That, he believes.
That's the thing.
He believes that, he absolutely believes what he's saying.
Yes, that first scene that he's in where he's driving and having a discussion with the Lord about, you know, looking for a widow with a lot of bills in the sugar bowl, he is sincere about everything that he says. He barely hides his evil because I think to him it's right. I don't know.
He's very much disturbing.
He's not like a flim flam man.
What's interesting is how people in the film have instant reactions to him. They either absolutely believe him or they absolutely do not.
For instance, when he is talking with the Spoons early on, and they say, "What exactly is your religion? What is your denomination?" And he says, I can't remember the exact line, but it's, you know, it's basically it's a belief that the Lord and I have agreed upon betwixt us. And
yes. Betwixt.
That is, I mean, it's a wonderful phrasing of that. But yeah, this is not Harold Hill consciously going in to con people and knowing what he's doing and getting away with it. This is a guy who believes fervently in what he's doing, and what he is doing is righteous and true and right. He wants the money to build a church.
I'm Whatever wondering, I've been trying to create a kind of a psychological history for him. And I just was starting to think, I wonder if he had a mother who was like Piper Laurie and Carrie. Ooh, some kind of, you know, extreme religious character, and maybe with some sexual overtones between them that warped him in this way. Yeah, how did he turn out like this? This woman hating sociopath who also doesn't have sex and with women, and which is also part of the original true life story, that that man didn't have sex with his conquests either. And apparently people think that was how he gained their trust, because they looked at him and thought, well, he's not after me for my body, so he must be legitimate.
Let me back up just a couple steps, because I wanted to do my quick Night of the Hunter origin story, only because the first time I saw this film was on a Saturday afternoon. I had a local TV station as a kid that would play a whole series of movies from the 50s to the early 70s, actually. And so it was really interesting film education. Some of the films were great, some of them were not. But Night of the Hunter was not something I expected on a Saturday afternoon. I expected a Western or The Umbrellas of Cherbourg or Mad Woman of Shiloh or something like that. And all of those came as The Sterile Cuckoo, you know, whatever it might have been. But you start watching this movie. Oh, Robert Mitchum, I know that guy. Oh, look, there's Shelley Winters. Okay. Oh, dear. It's gone a place. And I'm a young person, right? I'm in high school or whatever. And it's gone a place that I didn't expect it to go. And then so subsequently, the bottom line is I've seen it since, but not in a long time. And so there are a lot of things about this movie that on second or third viewing, it's not that just that you see differently, but that you remember differently. I think it's a film that's so complex that it's easy to sort of mishmash a few details about who does what and what scenes come in what order. And I sort of find that really interesting, because I had a real different conception of this movie before I watched it than when I watched it for this. And then let me back up also to just sort of introduce the movie itself. So it's directed by Charles Laughton, who folks will know from movies like Hunchback of Notre Dame and Henry VIII, if they ever saw the early 30s, Henry VIII. He appeared in many films. He's sort
Mr.
of a...
Christian!
Yes, exactly.
From Looney Tunes. Oh, right. Right.
And so he's known primarily as an actor, never quite not a beautiful leading man by any means, but definitely a presence on screen. He was married to Elsa Lanchester, who people will know as the Bride of Frankenstein. And that's relevant because they made a lot of films together. She potentially could have been in this movie, but she decided against it. I guess she would have had the Lillian Gish role, which is interesting. So he gets hired to direct this movie, which is based on, as Randy mentioned, it's a book from a couple of years before that had been a bestseller. And the book is in turn based on this real life Depression era story of Harry Powers, who, yes, went around defrauding and murdering widows and their kids as well. That's how he made his money in the Depression. And so that's how we get our film. Various people who had been considered for the cast. This is just to horrify you. I always like to horrify people by saying what we could have had.
Ronald
Reagan.
Had
Gary Cooper. No, Gary Cooper actually was considered. Gary Cooper turned it down, which I think was both wise and fortunate for us as viewers. as they say, Elsa Lanchester. I hadn't heard about a particular silent film folk that could have been the Lillian Gish role. And so we end up with Shelley Winters in a very, I won't say unusual role for her, but much more reserved sort of a role. And I think I said in the introduction to this movie that Billy Chapin, who was the kid protagonist in the movie, goes on to do a lot of television work. I'm actually thinking of his sister, Lauren Chapin, who was in Father Knows Best. There were three Chapin children who were all child actors, and who Lauren Chapin, probably the best known. But Billy Chapin was a highly regarded kid actor. There is dispute as to whether Charles Laughton hated the kids or not, because he actually cast Billy Chapin and admired his technique for a kid of that age. And I do as well. I actually think Chapin does a really, really good job. In other versions of the story, because Elsa Lanchester eventually wrote a memoir about her life with Charles Laughton. And I believe she's the one that sort of sends the impression that Laughton didn't necessarily like the kid, and that Mitchum actually had a really good relationship with the kids and was very helpful to them in terms of their performance. Let's see, what else? The appearance of Lillian Gish is interesting, because I think there is a perception probably that as a silent actor she hadn't worked in 30 years, which wasn't really true. She was making a lot of television appearances by the mid-50s. I think she'd show up in Westerns and bonnets and stuff like that. And she worked all the way up till the early 80s. I can't remember her last film. It might have been, she might have been in Whales of August or something.
I think
that.
She was. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so she's like, Lillian Gish is like, oh, wait, she was a big deal in the early 20s and she kept popping up till the 80s. This is the only film Lawton ever directed. He had, I think, hopes of directing further films, but this was not a success at the box office, partially because it was so weird, but not completely. Like, it wasn't like the audience said, oh, this is weird, I hate it, in the way that some other great films have been regarded. I think it just didn't strike a chord at all. I mean, Mitchum is the only real star in it, I guess. I guess Shelley Winters was, but this is not a starry part for her. And so Lawton just never directed again. And I'm sort of curious as to how hard he tried. By the 1950s, he's touring around in a Broadway show with people like Agnes Moorehead and who are the other people in that company? I can't remember. There was a four-person set of plays that they took around the country. And it was him and Agnes and a couple of other folks whose names are escaping me at the moment. So Lawton had plenty to do, but he just never went back to directing the film. I just felt like I had to throw all that exposition in there,
and
now we can get back to discussing the creepy movie.
Another casting pair to horrify people. Laurence Olivier was interested, but he was busy. He was like booked for 2 years, so oh well. So maybe he wasn't that interested in it. But I bet you could have gotten Jason Snell to watch it if John Carradine had been cast.
That's right. I forgot about the John Carradine connection. Right? Yes, indeed.
The power.
I was surprised to find the incomparable John Carradine connection because I know him from those weird 40s movies that I know him from. It's like, oh, okay. All right. Now we can talk about the same guy, but in very different movies.
He would have been a great Uncle Birdie.
He would have.
And actually, yeah, I want to say that about James Gleason, who plays Uncle Birdie. It's actually probably the best performance I've ever seen James Gleason give, because he played in 30s and 40s cops and henchmen and just sort of really broad characters a lot of the time. And this is a really interesting guy. He's playing an older person, of course, so he's not playing the same character he would normally play. But there's, you know, there's some depth to him and some uncertainty about like what his motivations are, and obviously he becomes relevant to the kids trying to escape later on. He finds Shelley Winter's body when she dies. Spoiler alert. So I think all of the performances in this movie are really interesting. There's not a one that I hate. There's not a one that's a scenery chewer, and Lawton could certainly as an actor be a scenery chewer, but I think he directs or the actors find in themselves just like really subdued performances. Even Mitchum, who's playing this character who's very intense and very scary, like he's not chewing scenery while he's doing
it. Even Peter Graves is in this movie, and he keeps muttering overdone. I don't know why he does that.
Baby Peter Graves.
Peter Graves. And this is A&E's biography. Today we talk about Charles Lawton. Good luck, Mr. Phelps.
Roger over, Victor.
Oh. Well, I was going to say about Mitchum. This is a fascinating role for him because, I mean, it's not on paper out of bounds of anything he's played before, right? He's creepy. He's a brute. He's the villain. But he plays it with such a light touch. This is not at all what you expect from Robert Mitchum. There's a musicality to everything he's doing, and not just because he sings for a large part of the film. It's almost like, you know, you take Mitchum aside and go, be Richard Widmark, but sexy, right? It is so unlike Robert Mitchum parts, and it's fantastic.
And then, you know, Mitchum's biography is called Baby, I Don't Care. But here he doesn't have that kind of loush personality. He does care. He's completely intense.
Yeah, he's usually cool and
detached. He is not just tossing this one off.
Exactly.
He is twitchy. He is
screechy and noisy and making strange sounds.
Yeah.
I love
and does sing, and it is not an unpleasant sound. And the way because they do it in those scenes where he's supposed to be some distance from the people to whom he's singing, it has an even better sort of creepy
resonance. You know, I have in my notes, you know, hey, brilliant move, singing loudly while you're sneaking up on people, but at the same time, it is exceptionally creepy. right? That's part of the coercive control. It's, you know, I'm not just hunting you. I'm going to let you know I'm hunting you, right?
Well, right. That's the whole point. And he thinks because he's hunting children in large part that he's going to get them. Like, mm-hmm. there's no opportunity for him to fail,
yeah.
even though he has, yeah. even though they escape early on because he trips and falls. And you know, it's not like a Home Alone situation where they bash him, which is sort of how I remembered it. I was like, oh, he messes up and they get out of the cellar and they run fast because they're little kids. But so he's already had a taste of not getting his quarry, but he continues to believe that he will and continues to follow them down that river, which is a part of the movie that I remember as being much longer than it actually is, which goes back to something you were saying, David, about how the scenes are constructed to sort of make you feel like their length is whatever the director wants you to think, as opposed to how long they actually are.
It's very much a film that iterates, reiterates, and evolves with each reiteration. And some of those reiterations get shorter and shorter and shorter. If you time some of those scenes, they do get shorter because you can fill in all the details now. There are a lot of scenes where the kids are looking at things and you only get a couple of details. It's very spare and minimal in a lot of scenes because you're filling in the details too, which is, again, that's Brechtian, it's German Expressionism, right? And because you're filling in the details, in your memory, it feels like a four-hour movie because it's, you know, there's so much there. It is so complex, and it's only 92 minutes, which is crazy.
And I'm sure that is also the case because children are at risk, right?
Yes.
And you're whether you're a parent or not, any adult who sees children at literal risk is going to perceive that risk as being of longer standing than they might otherwise.
One of the interpretations I read was talking about how this way of seeing the world, that you don't see everything, you focus on specific parts and make up the rest, is also how kids look at the world. So this interpretation was talking about how it's filmed in a way that that is as a kid would perceive things around them, just by focusing maybe on things they know and the rest not paying attention to, or maybe just looking at the world like you haven't gotten your first eyeglass prescription yet, and you're just picking up on the outlines.
I'll buy that, but at the same time, they don't do tricks where you're looking at it from a far lower point of view physically,
right.
or some sort of like complete lack of it. You're not showing things that the adult would see that the kid wouldn't see. You're actually giving the kid's point of view as the kid being to thinking to themselves, I am the size human I am supposed to be. I'm a normal sized person, but we're not going to tilt the camera up and look way up at Robert Mitchum and make him seem like he's 8 feet tall, because his presence is enough to convince you that he's tall and scary without doing that.
And his character is a stereotypical narcissist, because he wants all the attention. He's the good person. He's going to make you do what he wants you to do. And he's always right. And that's how he tries to manipulate them. It's how he tries to divide and conquer them throughout. It's always, I'm right, you're a bad person, don't listen to your brother, he might be a meddler. This knife is what I use on meddlers. You know, things like that. And again, it's a very sophisticated film in terms of illustrating that. It's so contemporary that way.
Yeah, and the way he deals with the little girl, Pearl, is so sophisticated, and they've really just met. And he has to have enormous confidence to believe that he's going to be able to do what he does, which is separate from her brother. Her brother manages to get her back, but just barely.
I will say that, you know, Shelley, you mentioned good acting from everyone in here. Pearl is really annoying.
Pearl and Icy.
Icy drives me crazy.
Icy is intentionally
annoying.
Yes,
I think she's an excellent actress for this role.
Yes,
Pearl is not, and there is unfortunately, I think those are the weakest parts of the movie to me. Are when Pearl is forced to carry a scene or at least part of a scene to contribute, because she's really not good at all. And I think Billy Chapin while, I mean, you know, obviously miles ahead of Pearl, whatever her name was. It's weird. I don't know whether it's because I was being drawn into the movie, or I don't know how the movie was shot. I don't know whether it was shot in sequence or just shot normally and out of sequence, but he seems to get better. And so my suspicion is that's me being drawn into the movie. And I'm losing my sense of disbelief as the movie goes on, and I get more concerned for him as a character. So I guess he is doing a good job there. Early on, I'm not having a good time with Billy either. I think he's hitting his lines the wrong way, and there's a lot of kids in this movie. A lot of time spent on the kids in this movie. And that's usually not a great thing, but it gets good, and especially once they get out and are on the river, I don't have a problem. I almost don't even have a problem with Pearl at that point. It becomes almost a silent movie at that point. That's one thing that's helpful. But I think when Billy has to talk and he's talking to Mrs. Cooper, Lillian Gish, I think he does a fine job during that section of the movie.
See, the way I see it, I think he's really good. And I also think the way they directed him to the fact that he is Pearl's protector is actually helpful in terms of disguising her limitations as an actress.
Yes.
And showing you his strengths, because not only does he do well on his own, but he does well in terms of taking control of the scene to the extent that he needs to. And so I don't know have any idea what their relationship, there's actually quite a bit of age difference between those two kids. And so I have no idea what kind of relationship they might have had personally, but you just sort of get the impression that his character is not only guiding her character, but that the actors are guiding each other, and that somehow that was aided by direction. So, and I think the only scene of his that I don't really care for is perhaps the Peter Graves scene, like when Peter Graves comes back as his father and says, you know, hide the money. And I think that's because you've caught the kid being a kid and you're telling him to do a thing that's completely foreign to him. Huh? And now all of a sudden, after Peter Graves is gone, he goes into this gothic world, because very soon after that, Peter Graves is dead. He's been executed. And then his mom dies. And then they have to go on the run from this terrible man who is now responsible for them. And so his life changes so much that his performance has to change, and would hopefully have to change, because you'd need a really good actor to do that sort of thing. And I feel like it's successful.
No, I'm gonna have to defend the little girl, especially because she might be listening, and I don't want to offend her.
Oh no,
she's actually still alive, and she's only 74. Her name is Sally Jane Bruce, and in her defense, from what I read, she filmed this movie when she was 5 years old. And she also filmed it when she was really, well, sorry, Sally, you were really kind of creepy looking at this time. It was a really strange little girl, but I was impressed that she was able to act as well as she did at that age, and especially in the scenes in the boat, and when she sings that Pretty Fly song. Apparently she was discovered because she was singing in a contest in Los Angeles. But apparently she was in this and one other movie, and then left Hollywood and became a teacher, and never looked back at the Ohio River or these pretty flies that are somewhere. Where are flies pretty? I don't understand.
Trying to get her a Zoom connection. She'll be a panelist on the next episode.
She was discovered singing, and then they dubbed her singing.
Yeah, apparently
not even her.
She sang the song Pretty Fly, her voice was too thin, and they had to have somebody else do it.
Yeah. It's funny. She was considered the Barbara Stanwyck of five-year-old child actors at the time, which explains so much.
No, I'll tell you what. I don't blame Sally Jane, Bruce. She was, after all, 5 years old.
Way to kiss up to Sally Jane.
Barbara Stanwyck had no excuse.
Well, Barbara Stanwyck isn't in this movie, I feel constrained to point out once again. Anyways, so let's talk about Shelley Winters. So I always like to try and think of what movies have we seen these people in before. And it occurred to me that the last time I saw Shelley Winters for an incomparable movie, it was actually not LTS. It was The Poseidon Adventure.
Oh, yeah.
She was a much different person at that point. She didn't survive either movie, by the way.
She just doesn't do well in water, you know, in the long run.
No. Just not... No swimming. She was deleted from Jaws.
I know you won the medal in high school, but right. You know, this isn't going to end well, Shelley.
Nope. Went near a swimming pool in Lolita.
Nope.
Oh, no.
One of the more memorable scenes is when, because he kills her with this knife that he carries around, spoiler alert, once again, too late, and then puts her in the Model T and sends the Model T in the river. And that is the thing that I remember. You know, everybody, there are things we remember, like the tattoo on the knuckles or the children at the top of the cellar stairs. I remember that car going underwater. That's the thing that always hits me.
And he seemed to not notice that the river is completely clear, but right? Maybe it was dark.
I will say, living on the Ohio River, there is no point on the Ohio River that is that crystal clear. That's like the Weeky Watchy Mermaid Show clear.
Wow. I like her performance in the movie because she can be twitchy and she can be sort of unhinged and insecure. And truly, she is, like, I think modern people who are always very concerned about children, not only their lives, but their the sort of details of their daily living. I think a lot of people would say Shelley Winters was not particularly attentive mother to her children. That is not my concern. I mean, sure, yeah, I don't, but she probably shouldn't have married Robert Mitchum, regardless of how she behaved as a mother in the rest of her life. But I enjoy her performance, not because it is great. I've seen her do other performances that I think I like better, but I think because, like other characters in the movie who have a chance to go over the top, she doesn't. This is not that kind of part. And actually, at this point in her career, I was sort of a little surprised that she would take a part that is both that small and so early in the film. but I thought she was good and yeah. Showed the proper amount of, you know, she has the unenviable job of when they finally are married and Robert Mitchum won't consummate and pretty soon he's you know, threatening her and you know, pretty soon after that she's dead.
She. I was impressed that she played the role in appearing so plain. You know, this was a very attractive woman at this time, and she's known for having affairs with you know, just about every male star in Hollywood at the time. But she really, I don't know if she was. It seemed like she was very, very little makeup and looking plain, and the character, and that's what the character is, very, very yeah. plain. And I thought, I always feel like for actresses at this time, it is, in some way, brave to play a role where you're not, pretty and looking attractive, because but it's not the same way for men, obviously, but I feel like it's for women that it's it must be challenging when your whole job as an actress is to look pretty on screen, and here you have a role where you don't do that, and that must seem, what do you think, what do you guys think? I hear doubt.
Well, I am gonna stand up for Shelley Winter's sex appeal in this movie. Yes, of course, she's plainly dressed because that's the character and stuff. But the wedding night scene, she is looking pretty hot, I thought.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And I think she had to. And it's within the character. It's within the context of a character at that place and in that time. But I think she has to be attractive. She has to look sexy because we need to be surprised at Mitchum's reaction.
Yes.
It made me, yeah.
Turning her down.
it made me wonder more about his, you know, his background. I wonder if maybe, well, we do see that he is turned on by women, or at least there are implications, like in that first scene at the strip joint,
the or the burlesque club, yeah.
joint, and you can see he scowls and the switchblade, the little tip pops out of his pants.
Yeah. Which is, I don't know,
a little on
Charles.
Yes,
so to speak.
Indeed.
Little on point. And, that's, yes, very much.
But
so.
But I was wondering if maybe he, he can't perform in the moment for whatever psychological reason or physical reason. Then maybe that's why he's turned on by women, but he avoids having sex with them.
Or he's turned on, but going back to the religious aspect, I mean, he disapproves of the burlesque woman that he is clearly paid to see perform. And that sort of righteous disapproval perhaps is what turns him on, which goes back to the idea that maybe he had an overbearing mother who was very religious. And so he can only get gratification. He wants to see an attractive woman, but in the context of having her offer herself to him in their bedroom as a married person, that isn't appealing to him somehow.
Yeah.
She has to abase herself by becoming clean enough for him.
Well, see, she's trying to figure it out. Like she says she has to become, he doesn't say this is how you cure it, but she sort of intuits that what she needs to do is somehow become clean enough for him.
Right.
And yeah, clearly she, you know, because the marriage was set up as, you know, you ought to marry him because you're getting older or whatever, or you need some income for those kids, although we don't see him work. She's got a job. So she get the impression that by the time she's decided to marry him, she's like, look, I know that part of marriage is a sexual relationship with this person, and I expect him to want that from me, and so I'm going to be available for it. It's not the sort of I'm going to grin and bear it or whatever. She's like, all right, here you are. Here I am. She probably finds him attractive. And so the only way she can understand and sort of make sense of it is to try and find, and she like everybody else, would have been steeped in some sort of religious dogma. So that's kind of how she deals with it.
Yeah. In that scene, before she goes into the bedroom, his jacket is hanging on a hook at the door, I think. And
yes.
I don't know, she notices that it's hanging funny or something, and she reaches into the pocket and pulls out his switchblade and says, men. in kind of a, no, not like that, actually. I did it wrong. She did it right. She's kind of amused by it.
Yeah.
You know, oh, those men. And their weapons.
Their toys.
that they're going to kill me with.
Right.
And you know, he doesn't kill her because of her, really. You know, he kills her because of what she knows about him threatening the kids.
Yep.
And even though she's up, we see her after she learns that he's threatening the kids, we see her kind of not caring. And so I at least did not like her at that point. But Mitchum sort of sees it as a threat, her knowledge as a threat. And so that's why he has to off her, because he doesn't trust her to stay bewitched by him.
Well, it's also a very, again, a classic narcissist controlling pose of, she's seen him being imperfect, and so he can't abide that.
Yeah. Even though she doesn't care.
Right. Exactly.
She doesn't care, but he doesn't. He thinks, you know.
I don't think he can trust it. Even if she says she doesn't care, there could come a point later, because there's no deniability left. She's seen him threaten those kids, and she could, in a moment of anger or just in a moment of reflection, say, "You threatened my kids, and you're terrible, and I'm going to think of a." You know, if she gets out of that house, if she has enough time to think about it, she may very well find a way to turn on him, and he's not really sure how smart she is about that, you know, and I don't want to take the risk.
Yeah, no, that is absolutely correct. This is not his first rodeo.
Right.
And so he knows that she cannot be trusted, even though she has not turned on him yet. And, you know, she certainly should have turned on him in the height of passion of seeing her kids being threatened by him, that's when she should have snapped. She doesn't, but he's thinking two steps ahead and she's got to go.
And then she is gone and he tells the story about her running off, which is entirely unbelievable. And this is where we get into sort of not being literal or real. We're telling a story. We're telling something in order to get the story to move further on. So, all of a sudden, this guy who she's just married is telling everybody else that she's gone and that he's going to raise her two children. And it's really sad that she's gone, but we're going to make the best of it. Nobody should believe that story at all, but they do.
He sets it up beautifully. Well, Lawton and the novelist and James Agee, who did the script, they set this up beautifully right off the bat, where he's got his little knuckle tattoos, and he goes, you're looking at those, you're wondering about those, and he literally says, "Would you like me to tell you the little story of left hand and right hand?" Mm-hmm. And he uses love and hate and good and evil, right? And he has this little spiel about the hands, and then everything he tells that's a story kind of mirrors and, again, echoes and iterates and reiterates. Although I will admit, the next time he goes, "Would you like to hear the story of left hand and right hand?" And all I could think was, Sadite. But that's me. It's a beautiful, again, a very subtle. There are a lot of Chekhov's guns in this, but they're almost all really subtle and they pay off beautifully. And that's one of them. That's one that just sort of runs through the narrative and the style of telling the story.
Well, I think he's wise in knowing that Mrs. Spoon sort of runs the community.
Yes.
And so all he has to do is get her on his side. So that's why after he kills Shelley Winters, he goes to them. He goes to the Spoons and tells his tale of woe about how she run off with, whatever, somebody. And he knows that Mrs. Spoon, who, by the way, I have her written down in my notes as Busybody. I didn't remember her name, even though it's written on the front of their store. I refer to it as Busybody throughout my notes. He knows that she'll run with it. And again, because even though he's obviously kind of small time in this business, he knows his business, and that's one of the great chilling parts about his character and the way Mitchum plays him,
and the smart way this film and this story and maybe even in the real life story it's based on, the smart way that this person infiltrates a community, finds the busybody, finds the very religious person who controls everything, who convinces everyone of everything. And he tries that again later with Lillian Gish, and she sees right through it because she knows John. And it's very telling that right off the bat, John sees through him from the minute he meets Robert Mitchum, right? He is swayed by this guy at all.
My guess is that the story about Shelley Winters' character running off is believable. They don't really talk about it, but my guess is that there's a perception of her being flighty or that she likes men or that somehow there's something in her character that would lead Mrs. Spoon, first name Icy, to believe that she would do this. Because if it was totally out of character, even Mrs. Spoon might have gone, "What are you talking about?" By the way, Mrs. Spoon has absolutely all of the vocal inflections. Evelyn Varden is the actress's name. I don't know her. I've never seen her before. Has all of the vocal inflections of Agnes Moorehead. If you closed her eyes, that's her. Yes. It's so weird.
Oh, Durwood.
Right, 100%. And I think Agnes Moorehead might have been considered for the Lillian Gish part. I read that she was on the list, and my thought was it has to be Icy Spoon, and she did play a lot of characters' roles that small, but I could also see her in the Lillian Gish role. perhaps a little less sympathetic. But in any case, yeah, it feels like he, whatever Robert Mitchum's character, whatever Harry Powell's evil, he has a pretty good read on people's psychology and what approach he can use that will work with them. And like he, yeah, you're right. He tries it with Billy Chapin. He tries it with John, and John immediately goes, nope, which is why he knows what, as soon as he meets Pearl, that divide and conquer is the way to go.
Right.
Yes.
And Ruby later on.
Yes. That character doesn't do a lot for me. I don't particularly care for that performance.
No.
I sort of felt like I get why she's there, but I guess I kept wondering, do we really need her? I mean, I guess we sort of do, but
she's kind of a plot device.
We need a dumb girl who falls for him, who says, "Yeah, they're at my house. Those kids
right,
are
tells
looking
him
for."
Stuff he needs to know.
Yeah. But yet a total plot device.
Do we want to talk about the trip down the river? The cellar scene, the trip. We don't want to. Okay, let's not talk. Because that's where our beautiful of our German expressionism and our filmmaking.
Beautiful.
There's so much going on. Shot by Stanley Cortez, who shot Magnificent Ambersons and a bunch of other movies. I think his quote was something like, "I always get picked to shoot something weird."
There are beautiful patterns on the water all through the film, but especially in this sequence.
My notes in here are spider web, frog, cattails, owl, turtle, rabbits, sheep.
Fox.
Yes, fox. I had stopped by then. I was getting writer's cramp.
A lot of animals.
I have a mnemonic for it. It's okay.
Check the bootleg to explain that.
Right. Now I have to put a bootlegger. Nobody will understand that.
Yay!
Well, I thought it was interesting, the portrayal of nature, because they easily could have gone into a trope of nature as dark and evil, or they could have gone the complete opposite way and like somehow the animals are subtly on their side or helping them or watching them. But this is all about nature is just indifferent. You might drown in it. You might find rescue through nature and the river, but nature is just there. It doesn't try to help people or hurt them or watch them. It's just completely indifferent to the good and the evil that's going on.
All good and evil comes from men.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. In a similar vein as my Senor Wenzel's note, I do have written down for that part, I wanted hyenas and alligators, and, you know.
And see, this is the part. Nature is photographed so beautifully, and the actors don't get in the way of it because the way they've directed those kids, and this is why I say Billy Chapin is doing not too much, and he's causing Pearl to not do too much. And then you have Robert Mitchum as this threatening off-screen primarily presence who is creating all of the evil. And you're doing a lot of things at once in that scene. You're doing all that beauty as well as you're doing these kids that are both scared and also, you know, surviving. And then you have Robert Mitchum as this specter that wants to catch them.
Yeah, I think I do want to give one last shout out to Uncle Bertie, who is both, I think James Gleason does a great job playing him, but I also think he's a great character. He is, John's sort of substitute dad after Peter Graves dies. And he's obviously, and it's kind of funny about the kids have been have left the cellar and are running away, and you know there's still the river. They go to Bertie. They can't get. He's passed out drunk because he saw Shelley Winters through the remarkably clear water as he was fishing, and he talks to his dead wife, whose photo is there in his little cabin. And he just can't take it anymore, and he passes out from drinking.
He thinks he's going to be suspected of the crime.
Absolutely. Yeah. He can't say anything about it because they won't trust Bertie. He's a drunk. He doesn't seem all that drunk before then. I mean, he has his nip in his coffee, to get his heart started or whatever euphemism he used. But he's a fairly competent person and a good thing, too, for the kids because, you know, he caulked up the skiff to make sure it was watertight, and it was. They get down the river to Lillian Gish without having to bail. So good on Uncle Bertie.
Indeed.
I wanted to also mention the mob scene at the end, which you know, the whole community kind of goes mad, and you remember that song, Janie's Got a Gun? All I could think of was Icy's Got an Axe.
Yeah, that Look was out. Disturbing.
Disturbing. It didn't go anywhere. It just they're going to lynch him, and the spoons kind of just go mad with this rage, along with the town people of our good community of Mountsville, and then he, you know, they take him out the back entrance, and he's never seen again. And apparently, the hangman's going to really enjoy this one. The ending, At the ending, I kept thinking that he was going to escape. I had like a memory that there was more to it at the ending than him just getting caught and going to jail and then getting kind of shuffled off for his own safety. But I felt like we needed more, maybe more of a comeuppance to see for him. But one of the interpretations I read was that he was, you know, shuffled into a car, and that was humiliating for him. But I don't know. It didn't seem like it had enough to really stick the landing.
He's going to swing.
Yeah. So we're saving him for you.
Bert. We don't need to see it. We know what's going to happen. Cause it happened to Peter Graves.
I will say, my favorite line in the Wikipedia page about the movie, you know, where it lists the cast, and then the last credit is Paul Breyer as Bart the Hangman, parentheses, uncredited. Yes. It just makes me laugh.
Yeah, just left it hanging, did it?
Swinging.
I think the most interesting part about that, and the two most interesting parts about that end scene, the town getting ready to lynch him, which I always interpret as they made a mistake before, and now that their mistake has been rubbed in their face, they are going to get their vengeance, which is, yes. I think they would typically have been a riled up mob. They absolutely have lynch mob written all over their faces early on. But the fact that they've been humiliated, you know, it's not because Shelley Winters was everybody's best friend in town, but they've been made to look foolish. And then, of course, the second part is when when they capture Harry and John sees they're beating him up, and he has the flashback to his father, and he's got, you know, PTSD. This poor little kid who has been strong throughout this whole movie and saved his sister and gotten them down the river and found Lillian Gish and figured out he can trust her and still come face to face with Harry a couple times. You know, finally he's cracked because he's reminded of terrible things that have happened. And now, of course, both of his parents are dead, and I don't know what's up, what's ahead for John, other than at the end, he's, you know, clearly still welcome at Lillian Gish's house.
Speaking of Lillian Gish around this time was only about 62.
61, yeah.
Yeah, and she plays a character that comes across older, that, you know, and it's described as elderly in a lot of the write-ups about the movie, and as somebody who's getting closer and closer to 61, I'm like...
But she's sprightly. Like, I don't think, I mean, she may have been costumed and she may have, you know, elderly and all that, but she does not give the impression, either by word or deed, of somebody who is, you know, ready for the rocking chair. Clearly she has this mission to take care of these kids, and she also is pretty clever about, you know, drawing Harry out and figuring out a way to get him. So I think her being older is probably more of an explanation of why she's doing what she's doing, which is, you know, raising, maybe she's previously raised a family. We hear about her son. Yeah. And now she's raising this group of foundlings, basically.
Well, and here's another one of those beautiful narrative Chekhov's guns, is that you have early on, like Icy is talking about, how could Willa raise children by herself? A single woman can't raise kids by themselves. You need to have a man. But she's the very religious type. And yet here is Lillian Gish as a religious type who has no problem raising a whole bunch of kids by herself. And so that's an interesting echo and evolution, right? He takes down the woman who can't do it and is taken down by the woman who can.
Well, there are two echoes because Harry, when Willa is gone, says, I'm going to raise the kids. And Icy doesn't go, you can't raise the kids. You're a single man. She just accepts it, you know?
Yeah.
So why do you guys think Harry Powell decides to take a switchblade to a shotgun fight? What is he thinking?
Again, arrogance, narcissism. He's going to win.
Yeah.
She's a woman. She can't fire a shotgun. And that's why, like, his reaction when he's shot is way out of proportion. He is shrieking and running away because he's been wounded by this woman. She can't do that to him. Right? And that's
his whole,
and then he hides. He just hides.
Yeah, because in the scene before, you know, he says, yeah, I'll be back when it's dark. And he just assumes, based on his experience, no doubt, that he's going to get what he wants.
Yep.
I want them kids.
Sure. Yep.
He's going to get them kids.
Now that is
And she is much better than anyone he has run into. Much more capable, and she beats him, you know, and it's a great part, and I think Lillian Gish does a great job with it. She is, and I said this at the beginning, I think overburdened as an actress with having to be a good religious person and having to give these speeches all the time that bring in scripture because they need the film to not have the only religious person to be Harry Powell. And it still didn't work fully. You know, it's still, as Randy said, you know, it still got banned in places and, you know, for obvious reasons, not good reasons, but obvious reasons. But I think they overwrote her character.
Yes.
With the preachy stuff. And that's unfortunate. I think she does a decent job with it. But it seems too much. Maybe that's, you know, me looking at this in the 2020s as opposed to looking at it in 1955. I might have had a different thought about it back then.
I got to say that whole scene where she's sitting there on the porch waiting with the shotgun is maybe my favorite scene in the whole movie because it is so artfully constructed, both writing and directorially, where, you know, he's been singing this one hymn through the whole movie. That's his calling card. I'm going to creep you out by singing this song. And she knows the counterpoint to it.
She joined him.
And she's the one. He's just talking about the arms, and she's the one who brings in Jesus. And so she's countering him. She's like, I can name the guy. You can't. Right. And then you realize they're singing this duet in counterpoint, and you realize he's sitting right in the yard. He's, you know, just a few yards away. And so, again, you know, beautiful staging and blocking and construction. And then Ruby comes in with her candle, and the candle blinds the screen behind them. And she's like, why do you have that candle? And snuffs out the candle, and he's gone. And that is just a beautiful moment. It's like, oh, that's creepy.
So my friend and I watched this movie last night. And when we got done, he rewound the DVD or whatever you do to a DVD to the beginning.
You flipped back.
How old are you, Randy?
Press the button. We went back to the very beginning. Because he's like, didn't we see Lillian Gish at the beginning? Mm-hmm. And we'd kind of forgotten it. But yeah, there's her, and you see the children, and you also see this kind of boy you don't recognize among the kids that she's talking to. I don't know where that kid came from, but what was she talking
Maybe
about?
That was
the false prophets? No, that was the lion in sheep's clothing, wasn't it?
That's the beware of false prophets.
But maybe that's her son.
Yeah, possibly.
Who we never see.
I feel like there's a lot in this movie that was either potentially there were more scenes or just they said the audience is smart and they're going to get all these connections because I think you can continue to find them. And I see it a little differently every time I see it. And I feel like if I were looking, if I were doing a book report and I had to make all the connections, I probably could see it a couple more times and not get every single one of them. But that's pretty plausible.
That scene was apparently supposed to be at the end and they realized somewhere along the line, no, that's the opening. That's the opening.
And it does kind of balance out the evil pastor. That they might have done it for that reason.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, this time when I saw it, I don't know what I thought about that first scene before with Lillian Gish. This time I thought of it as sort of as if the rest of the movie is a flashback.
That's
her afterward.
Interesting.
It could be.
And she's, but I don't think, I mean, there's nothing that says that. I just kind of got that impression this time.
It kind of doesn't matter. Like, I thought it's just a filmmaking flourish. I didn't really think of it as a realistic piece in the story, but I think it could work either way.
I think it's again, one of those Chekhov's guns because, you know, when they first meet Lillian Gish for real, she's like, "You kids get up here. I'm going to beat you with a switch. Get up here." Right. And she seems kind of mean until you realize, oh, wait, she's got a whole group of, you know, foster kids, basically. And I think it's a way of saying you're going to meet this woman. She's good. It's OK. Right. Yes, she is religious, but she's good. And
you do see a scene where she's like, "I would never whip you," you know, something like that.
Right. And so it's just a signifier to be like, you know, don't be scared of her when you meet her. Cause she doesn't appear until like, I don't know, 50 minutes in or 55 minutes in. It's like most of the movie.
Maybe longer than that. It feels like it's like 2/3 of the way through, which is, close to the hour.
Yeah, I guess it is longer. Yeah. Cause Shelley Winters dies around 40 minutes in.
So speaking of going 55 minutes in, you know, I think like they used to say on Nightline, I'm going to do my Ted Koppel and say we're going to need to alert our affiliates that we're going to be going over a little bit.
I'm Ted Koppel, and I sound a lot like my impression of Peter Graves. And this is Nightline.
Overdone.
Well, there you go. Any other final thoughts on Night of the Hunter?
I think one of the nice things about Lillian Gish's performance, and I'm sure this has to do with the way it's written too. Oh, and I did want to say something about James Agee, is that she softens.
Yes.
During her section.
Yeah.
On there, she starts off as kind of a hard ass. You kind of know. Obviously, you know, because why else would she have all these kids if she's not a good-hearted person? But she doesn't show it. But she starts showing it more and more as time goes on in the movie. And the other thing, does anyone know why Charles Laughton wanted to make this movie? Because I can imagine why James Agee would want to write it. Because he was from the South originally. And he had gone back during the Depression to the South to do a book with, who's the photographer? Anyway, he had a connection to the South. He had a connection to rural people that I don't think Charles Laughton had. And has anyone read anything about why Laughton wanted to do this story?
I read that Laughton connected to the author. I'm not sure how they got together, but he did connect to the author. And there's actually some question as to how much James Agee actually wrote, because he was actually suffering from quite a lot of alcoholism at this time. And so Laughton is supposed to have written quite a bit of it, which is very surprising. Like I that's even more puzzling to me, is that Laughton could so well and truly capture this story.
I have read though that other scholarship, with looking through first drafts and things like that, say an awful lot of this really is Agee. So too much of it. In fact, he wrote a movie that would have taken 6 hours or 5 hours or something like that.
Yeah, it was like 280 pages.
Right,
it was huge, and it had to be cut down, and that was Lawton, I think, to a large extent, from what I've read. But I think the current belief is that AG really did write an awful lot of this. So, Shelley, Lawton found the author, not AG, but the author of the book.
Right.
Supposedly, a literary agent sent the book to Paul Gregory, who is Paul Gregory Productions, but he was also Lawton's manager.
Yeah.
And Lawton really twigged to it. He got in touch with the author, went to Philadelphia, and spent like a week just brainstorming how this would be such a wonderful play or film, or, you know, how to do it. And the author started sketching out, you know, basically a lot of the storyboards were the author's sketches of the story. Mm. So it, you know, if he had ambitions to become a film director, I can see how, you know, you get excited by the imagery, you get excited by the story. It is a dynamic character to make a film about. I mean, and not a character you'd seen very much portrayed that way.
No, absolutely. And he certainly got a tremendous performance out of Mitchum. Okay. And a lot of people don't get tremendous performances out of Mitchum.
Right.
But it was just an artistic connection.
Yeah.
And that it's not, because it certainly isn't anything from his life.
And he took so personally that he never made another, he never directed another film, which is a shame because this is really kind of an amazing film.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the original true life story. It just got, there is a film journal called Noir City. It's published by Eddie Muller, the Czar of Noir, and I've actually written for it. And the latest issue is about the real life inspirations for noir movies. And there's a big story about the inspiration for this movie, which was a killer in West Virginia in the 1920s. His name was Harry Powers. He was a little bit different because he was kind of pudgy, nebbishy character. But it was during the Depression, and he was a smooth talker, and he created what he called the widow racket to basically get women to fall in love with him, take their money, and then kill them. And like the Mitchum character, he avoided having sex with them. That was something they took from real life. And he was actually he was tried, I think, in Moundsville, which is a real place in West Virginia. And this was a huge celebrity trial, and they actually had to move the trial to an opera house because they had so many spectators. And who knew Moundsville had a had an opera house? And
we had an opera house here. Now it's a parking lot.
Really?
But we did have one.
Oh.
They paved paradise and they put up a parking lot.
That's right.
Yeah. And he was, there was a real life mob scene, a group of angry citizens gathering outside the jail. And this murderer had to be taken away, hidden in a car. And then he was, I'm looking to see if he was actually. Yes, he was hanged, and he dangled for 11 minutes before being declared dead. So some reporter had a stopwatch, just like John Harper had in this movie. Nice, a good watch.
I think that was something they tracked when they hung people. They actually kept track of how long somebody lasted, and 11 minutes is quite some time.
One thing I wanted to bring up, you know, I haven't seen the original Cape Fear in a while, but I know Robert Mitchum plays a criminal who's threatening a young woman, the daughter of Gregory Peck, right? I was wondering if you guys remember that.
If
you had any comparisons about his, you know, poor Mitchum is always menacing children around this time.
And he's got tattoos on his knuckles and everything. And I mean, I was going to say, back when I can't even remember the name of the episode, but the Simpsons episode with Sideshow Bob that is basically Cape Fear, it's actually Night of the Hunter because he's threatening Bart throughout.
And doesn't he have, he only has, I just read something about that, and Sideshow Bob only has three fingers, so it says like L-O-V and hat.
Yeah, yeah, because, oh, because all the Simpsons characters only have four fingers. And yeah, you know, at the end of this movie, as Mitchum is running off when he's shot, I just wished the yard were full of rakes for just that scene. Again, you know, in my notes, along with Senor Wences, I have a field full of rakes. I have, you'll shoot your eye out, Gish. I mean, I would totally MST3K this movie.
Oh, absolutely.
But...
Well, friends, thank you so much for joining me for this conversation about Night of the Hunter, and thank you, affiliates, for letting us go over time. We'll be back next week with an episode about a very different film, Kind Hearts and Coronets, 1949 film with Alec Guinness being funny, other people being funny as well. Until then, you can find us at theincomparable.com/LTS. You can find us on the socials at Lion Tower Shield, because S's cost extra. You can also drop us an, I think they call them email? Email. That's it. At LTS at theincomparable.com.
I wish you all love and hat.
and Merry Christmas to one and all.
This will be published on Thanksgiving Day, I just realized. So happy turkey gobble to all. Woo-hoo. And to all a good night.